This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Well, we've just had a macroscopic picture of the world and its challenges and its solutions. We're now going to turn a microscope to that same picture. Greg Mortensen is one of my personal heroes. From homeless mountain climber to tireless humanitarian, he has lived and built schools, mainly for girls, in places where few Westerners ever set foot. His story is an inspirational testimony to what can be accomplished if we set aside our fears and our prejudices, put our feet to the ground, and dedicate our lives with single-minded passion to concrete goals, however difficult they may be. Three cups of tea is impossible to put down. It begins with the drama of his failed effort to summit K2, the world's second highest, most challenging, and most dangerous mountain. Failed not because Greg lacked the ability to make the final summit attempt, but because he had exhausted himself on a sleepless 3-day life-saving rescue near the summit of a fellow climber. He wouldn't tell you that himself. That selfless act struck me as emblematic of his life and the rewards that can come with sacrifice. Exhausted, disoriented, he hiked for 5 days down a rugged, glaciated valley, missing a turn in the trail and stumbling into the tiny Pakistani village of Corfe, where a 6'4" emaciated Westerner was a truly unique sight. The people of Corfe took him in and nursed him back to health. In a culture where time moves slowly and relationships are developed over endless cups of buttered tea, Greg became family to people who had every reason to fear and shun him. Before he left, he saw 84 children doing their lessons in the dirt, and in gratitude, he vowed to return and build them a school. This seemingly rash promise was not as impulsive as it may seem. Greg had grown up on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, where his mother had started a school and his father had worked for a decade to raise millions of dollars to build a medical center. Patience and tenacity were part of his family's Lutheran missionary background, qualities that are required to scale the world's highest peaks or build schools in the world's remotest regions. That was 15 years ago. Since then, Greg has returned numerous times to Pakistan, building 70 schools that have served more than 26,000 children. Penniless at the beginning, he had to sell the beat up Buick that served as his only home in Berkeley to raise money for his first trip back to Pakistan. He eventually created the support of donors, creating the Central Asia Institute and the Pennies for Peace program, which involves American school children raising money for his schools. The regions where he works now, which include the border areas of Afghanistan, are the heartland of what we think of as Islamic fundamentalism. Three Cups of Tea's greatest gift to me personally has been to put a human face on these remote village people, people who share tea with an American humanitarian, even as their villages are caught in the crossfire of war. The Central Asia Institute's mission statement reads, "To promote peace by educating children, especially girls, who, because of poverty, isolation, gender discrimination, corrupt government, and religious extremism, are denied the right to learn." What better way to promote peace? Let's give a Santa Barbara welcome to Greg Mortensen.
Thank you. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum, and peace be with you. Thank you, Jeffrey. That was so inspiring. I've been hearing about you and reading your book and toting your book all over. And our Pennies for Peace program is actually, we talk about 1% for peace. So thanks, Jeffrey, so much for your beautiful talk, and especially your 10-point summary that I think, you know, any political party, if they want to win the campaign, just put that 10-point thing into action, you can win the elections. And I'd like to thank Celeste and also Roman. They've worked so hard. They do events here nearly every night. They've been working on this for months. Thank you for your patience and persistence. And also to all the team back there and to Richard. And I'd also like to thank the Orca School. We have a very special relationship with Orca School from many years ago. We were having trouble getting funds to build one of our first schools in Afghanistan. And I think at the time, Orca School had about 34 children. And they raised money to build the Kali Panj School in Afghanistan, which is thriving today. Now there are, I think, 11 kids in Orca School, and there's about 450 students in Afghanistan getting an education. Thank you. And I had the great pleasure today to, I've been to several schools from kindergarten through graduate school, the Crane School, Santa Barbara Middle School, Direct Relief International, and UCSB, their graduate program. It's been such a joy to talk with the students in the community here. One of the first questions I asked students, K through 12, and also at the Naval Academy and Air Force Academy, is how many of you have talked in great detail to your grandparents or your elders about World War II or the Depression or the Vietnam War or the Civil Rights Movement? Or perhaps when your parents came from a distant land and came to this country of America? And only about 10% of the hands come up here in America. Today in Santa Barbara is about 20%, so actually a little better. If I ask that same question in Pakistan or Afghanistan, 90% of the hands come up. And I think it's a great tragedy that in our society, we don't have the oral tradition, the folklore, the culture, the heritage that comes from our elders down to the second generation. In honor of that today, I'd like to share with you a little story called Three Cups of Tea. How many of you read Three Cups of Tea? Okay. So, Three Cups of Tea, an old village chief in Corfe in Pakistan once told me, it had taken 3 years, I still didn't have a school built, and one day he told me, you need to sit down and be quiet and let us do the work, and you need to have three cups of tea. Now, I've already had 5,000 cups of tea there, and he said, the first cup of tea, you're a stranger, second cup of tea, you're a friend, and third cup of tea, you become family. But the process takes several years, and for our family, we are prepared to do anything, even die. What some of you might not know about, though, is a subtitle of the book. When I wrote the first manuscript and I submitted it to Manhattan, they told me that the subtitle of Three Cups of Tea would be One Man's Mission to Fight Terrorism One School at a Time. Now, I'm a veteran, but I was very opposed to that because I said, I grew up in Africa, my parents were educators, I've been doing this for 8 years before 9/11, and the reason I do this is to promote peace. And I said, I don't like that subtitle. Well, they said, we're going to need that subtitle because we need to catch the media so we can pitch the book. And I persisted, and finally I went to Manhattan, and I summoned a jirga. It's like a tribal council. And this is in the headquarters of Penguin Putnam. And there was Susan Kennedy and the head of marketing and the head of publicity. And I very eloquently tried to state my case of why I'm trying to promote peace, not fighting terrorism. They said, son, you know, you need to learn a couple things about the publishing industry. First of all, only 12% of nonfiction books make a profit, and 2/3 of all bestsellers are pre-chosen by us, the publisher. And in order to, we'd like to support your book, but you need to be fighting terrorism so we can, you know, get this book out there. Well, finally, I conceded, but having worked in Pakistan and Afghanistan for many years, you never settle a deal without driving a hard bargain on the side. So I said, if the hardcover doesn't do well, I want the paperback subtitle changed to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. So the hardcover came out 2006, and over a year it only sold about 20,000 copies. They had hoped for another zero or two behind that. I was in Pakistan in Azad Kashmir in the earthquake area in December 2006, and Paul Slovak, who's a new editor on the book, he called me up. He said, "Greg, we've decided to change the subtitle to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace One School at a Time." So the paperback came out January 30th last year with a new subtitle, and it's been a New York Times bestseller ever since then. Now, like 68 weeks later, now it's been 6 weeks number one, and the Pentagon last month bought several thousand copies to use for counterintelligence training. When I was 3 weeks old, my parents took me to Tanganyika, 1958, where I grew up for 15 years. My parents were teachers. My father eventually saw a need to have medical education in Africa. So he started the Good Samaritan Foundation, and eventually the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center. It took him 10 years to raise $6 million in the 60s. The first 9 years, he raised $1 million. The 10th year, he raised $6 million. When it got time to open the hospital in 72, Julius Nyerere, the visionary leader of Tanzania, got up and spoke. And then my father got up and gave a little talk, and he said, "In 10 years, all the department heads from this hospital will be from Tanzania." And there was kind of a chuckle that went out amongst the expats. And afterwards, the Europeans and Americans told my father, "How could you dare say such a thing to set the people up for such an unrealistic expectation?" So we came back to the States in the 70s, and my father died from cancer in his 40s. But 10 years later, we got the annual report from the hospital, and all the department heads were from Tanzania. And even today, I was in Louisville, Kentucky last month. An infectious disease doctor told me he had been there 2 months ago, and all the department heads, 37 years later, are still from Tanzania. Finally, you know, I grew up in, I call it paradise. It was post-colonial, new democracy. The game parks were just starting to come into place. I went to school with children from 24 different countries. I got to go into mosques and synagogues and temples and where Sikhs and Hindus and Muslims and Christians and Jews worshipped, and it was a beautiful place. When I was just about 15, we came back to America, and I was really excited, you know, a place of Cracker Jacks and 4th of July's and fireworks. And my first day in high school, in St. Paul, Minnesota, in homeroom, I got beat up. The kids put a garbage can over my head and they started pounding on it. And it was because I said I'm an African, and there was some confusion about that. But you know, it was the first time in my life I learned what the word racism meant. It was the first time I learned about prejudice. And it wasn't in Africa, it was here in America. 4 days after high school, in June of 75, I did something that was very unpopular at the time. I joined the U.S. Army. It was right after the Vietnam War. And I did it not only to serve my country, but to get a GI Bill so I could get an education. It was actually in the Army where I met men and women from all across America. And I realized that this is a great country, but not because of our commonality, but because of our great diversity. In Africa, as a child, and I'm sure Jeffrey can allude to this proverb, there's a beautiful proverb that says, if you educate a boy, you educate an individual. But if you educate a girl, you educate a community. And I could stop right here now because this is the whole essence of what I'm going to be talking about all night long here. You want me to stop here? Okay. I had three sisters, and my youngest sister, her name was Krista. And Krista was a very special girl, but it was because she suffered from severe epilepsy. She had actually got a botched smallpox vaccine when she was 3 years old. She got meningitis and subsequently high fevers. And she struggled with everything she did. It used to take Krista an hour or two the night before school. She'd pack her bags, She'd make her lunch ready. She'd get her homework done. She'd get everything lined up. I'm kind of the five-minute bed-to-bus kind of guy. You know, I'm out the door and trying to get to school and do my homework at the same time. In 92, Krista saw the baseball movie called Field of Dreams, and she was very inspired by it. Actually, at the Crane School this morning, some guy, he raised his hand and said, that movie was in 89. And I said, well, she saw it in 92, but that movie's in 89. I realized I'm near Hollywood here, so I better get my dates right. So she saw the movie. For her 23rd birthday, she wanted to drive from Minneapolis down to Dyersville, Iowa, to see the place where the movie was filmed. She packed her bags, but when my mother went to wake up Krista, July 24th, 1992, Krista died in her sleep from a massive seizure. And we were all devastated by it. So at the time, I used to be a, say, dirtbag climber. I was living up, you know, up the coast here in Berkeley in the Bay Area. So I decided I'm going to pick a big, bad mountain to climb for Krista and take her amber necklace that she had gotten in Africa and put it on top of K2, the world's second highest mountain, to honor her memory. A year later, I went to Pakistan, and this is the Karakoram mountain range. Karakoram means black rubble in ancient Turkish, and this is the greatest consolidation of high peaks in the world. There are 64 peaks above 23,000 feet high in a 100-mile area. Is that I-5? What's that freeway? Next time you go down I-5, clock yourself 5 miles and then pretend you're going straight up. That's how high these peaks are. This is K2, the world's second highest mountain. You can put 84 Matterhorns inside of K2 to fill it up. And the first attempt was by the Duke of Abruzzi in 1909. He reached halfway up on the right-hand side. He was wearing hobnail boots, tweed jacket, and being a gentleman, he even wore a tie. He didn't wear a tie tonight. And he was eating cans of sardines. We didn't have a lot of money, and I hope there's no outdoor retailers here, but we had two-season family camping tents from Logan, Utah. They're $50 each. And the green tent in the right foreground is a French Legionnaire's tent, which is designed for the Algerian desert in the Sahara. And the yellow tent is a North Face prototype tent. It's 20 years old. It's called a wind tunnel. And that's what we kind of used in our base camp. 12 climbers, 5 countries. Our goal was to get to the top of K2. The gentleman in the middle, I won't tell you where he's from. He's the guy without the shirt. But he left after 1 week because he said there's no whiskey in Pakistan. That's a true story. An avalanche, and you can see in the right foreground some little blue tents. And if you have a magnifying glass, you can see 5 Spaniards in their underwear running out of the tent. And this is the only environmental lesson I have for the day. See, they were supposed to go to the bathroom on the left-hand side of the glacier and get their drinking water on the right-hand side of the glacier, but they were a little bit lazy, so they did everything on the right-hand side. But after the avalanche came down, we said that was their karma, so they started following the rules and going to the bathroom on the appropriate side of the glacier. This is the west ridge of K2. On your left-hand side is China, and on your right-hand side is Pakistan. Now, we had a Pakistan visa, but we didn't have a Chinese visa, but we didn't see any gun-toting Chinese border guards, so we did enter illegally into China, and then we made our way back up into the right and up into Pakistan and up to the summit. And finally, 78 days later, it was time to go home. My two partners did summit. I didn't quite make it to the top. Most of all, I felt as if I'd let my sister down. When I came off K2, I kept putting my hand in my pocket and feeling that amber necklace. And if you read Three Cups of Tea, does anybody in the audience here remember what the first chapter is called? Good. She remembered the first word in the first chapter is failure. It's an F word that we don't like to talk about in America. And again, when I submitted the manuscript to Manhattan, they said, Greg, in America, you never start a book with the word failure. It's bound to fail. But, you know, we all make mistakes in our lives, and we all fail. When I turned 16, I went to take my driver's license test, and we didn't have a lot of money, so we had a little Honda Civic. This is like in 72. And I went to Parallel Park, the car, and I totaled the family car, and I flunked my driver's license test. In college, I used to play football. We actually won the NAIA Division II National Championship, but we did lose one game, and that was because I had to kick a 28-yard field goal when we're behind 16-17 at the end of the game. And it's really easy to kick a 28-yard field goal. You just kick the ball and it goes through the posts. Well, I lined up, kicked the ball, it went to the left, and we lost the game. Some of us fail on our investments. Some of us fail with global policy. Some of us burn cookies in the oven. And some of us, you know, in our relationships, and we all fail. And when that moment happens, think of this very beautiful Persian proverb: when it is dark, you can see the stars. And if you look up here, I think you can see some stars in the auditorium. So this is a good moment for all of us. So here we are. I have to walk 58 miles, carry 90 pounds. I was struggling along the Baltoro Glacier. And finally, I got into this little village called Corfe. When I got to Corfe, the village chief, Haji Ali, is kind of a stout man with a silver beard. He's kind of squat, very gruff. First he said, "Salam alaikum," which means peace be with you. And then he looked at me, and he shook his head, and he said, "Chizale." Now, being from the Midwest, the best translation I can think of the word chizale is "what the heck." You know, I had weather beaten, my pants were ripped, and I was this gangly American, and I wandered into the village. I hadn't even taken a bath in 84 days. And Haji Ali first said, "Welcome to our village, but first you do need to take a bath." So he took me down to the river, very icy, silty Braldu River. He washed up, and I went to his house for tea. And I've learned many things now, having worked in very rural, remote areas in Pakistan and Afghanistan over the last 15 years. One out of three children born dies before the age of one. The literacy rate in many areas is 2 or 5%, or often it's non-existent. Many of the men, about half the men, leave the villages to go down to the city to get jobs as dishwashers, road construction crews, and many other endeavors. Only half those men actually get money. Who's left behind? It's the women. And the women now tell me that their workload has doubled in the last 2 or 3 decades because the men have left the village. We took a study of the hemoglobin, the red blood cell level of 18 women in 1998. Most of the women had a hemoglobin of 8 to 9. And most of the women here, your hemoglobin is 12 or 13. And if you were hemoglobin of 8, you'd be in an ambulance with a siren on, going to get a pint of blood. So this is actually the first picture I took in September 93. I was a stranger, and they were a stranger to me. And we'd yet to have 3 cups of tea with each other. I went behind the village, and I saw 84 children sitting in the dirt, 5 girls, 79 boys. Most of the kids were riding with sticks in the sand. And when a young girl named Chocho came up to me, she said, "Could you help us build a school?" I made a rash promise that day, and I said, "I promise I'll help you build a school." And little did I know that that would change my life forever. You know what Jeffrey was talking about? One thing he didn't mention is that he goes to many of these countries, and he's with poverty. And to understand poverty and to deal with poverty, we need to touch poverty. We need to smell poverty. We need to taste poverty. We need to be with poverty. And you can't solve poverty from a think tank in Washington, D.C. And words that he was resonating really are so true, because Jeffrey's been there. And to really understand poverty, we need to be with poverty and embrace poverty so that we can alleviate poverty. Well, I came back to America. I had to raise $12,000, and since most of you read the book, you know this little routine, but I had no clue how to fundraise. I had raised $12,000 for this little school in Pakistan. So the first thing I did is I went to the local library, and we looked up the name of 580 celebrities and movie stars and sports heroes. I didn't know how to use a computer in 93, so I hand-typed 580 letters over 10 weeks. "Dear Michael Jordan," "Dear Sylvester Stallone." And guess what happened? Nothing happened. Then at Christmas time, I got one check for $100 from Tom Brokaw, the newscaster. and it said, "Good luck, Greg." And Tom, actually, he's wrote a blurb on the front of Three Cups of Tea that's really helped the book sales. But he invited us to come out to his ranch. He's moved to Montana recently, where we live. And we went to his ranch, and I asked, Tom's kind of been avoiding me lately. So I asked Tom, "How come you're avoiding me lately?" He said, "Well, Greg, I'm kind of embarrassed because a lot of people are coming up to me and talking about this Three Cups of Tea thing, and I only wrote you a $100 check." And I told Tom, I said, "Actually, Tom, I'm really grateful for your help because you've inspired hundreds of other people to write a $101 check." I didn't quite have the guts to say, "You know, you can still write another check." And then my daughter had insult injury. My daughter is 11, and she's in sixth grade. She loves math, and we were doing homework last fall, and she looked up at me. She was kind of distracted. She looked up at me and said, "Daddy, I figured out that in 93 you spent $112 and you only raised $100 on postage. You spent $112. Well, then I sold my car, some of that higher math that Jeffrey and I are trying to figure out. I sold my car. I lived in my car to save money. I sold everything I own, my climbing gear. By springtime, it only raised $2,400. And my mother, who's a principal in Westside Elementary School in Wisconsin, she invited me to come and talk to the kids. It was very inspiring when I got ready to leave. A fourth grader named Jeffrey. Jeffrey came up to me and he said, "I have a piggy bank at home and I'm going to help you raise money for that school." And he kind of looked at me deadpan. I didn't think anything of it. And in 6 weeks, they had raised 62,340 pennies. And when you think about it, it wasn't celebrities, it wasn't movie stars, it wasn't even adults, it was children in innocence and purity reaching out to children halfway around the world. And they did it with pennies. So what can you do with a penny? You know, what can you buy with a penny in Santa Barbara? Well, actually, you can do a lot of things with a penny. And we have this program now called Pennies for Peace. It's kind of going bananas lately. It was in 170 schools last year, and now it's in 1,700 schools. And we think in the next year it's going to go into 10,000 schools in America. And that program... it teaches kids about philanthropy, about cross-culture awareness. We encourage students every year to pick a different program to support. And also, we get involved with part of the Millennium Goals, and we tell kids they can get political with their pennies. So how can you get political? About 20 years ago, we signed an agreement that we'd give 1% of GDP to foreign aid. And as we heard earlier, the U.S. hasn't done very well. And actually, last year, we spent 0.17% of GDP to foreign aid. So the kids have sent tens of thousands of letters up to Capitol Hill to their leaders, and they write on there, "When I grow up, I'm going to make sure that we give 1% of GDP to foreign aid." And I guarantee you that those senators and Congress people are listening to those, you know, thousands of letters that are going up on Capitol Hill. So finally, went back to Pakistan, to Karakoram Highway. This is in the fall of 94. When I got to Corfe, Haji Ali greeted me. I brought the school supplies, but I hadn't thought, you know, there's no phone, no email, no postal system there, and he's very surprised I come back. And not only that, I brought the school supplies. But again, Haji Ali looked at me, and he said, "Chisole." Because he said, "We didn't think you're coming back, but if you really want to build a school, first we're going to have to build a bridge." So I hadn't thought of that, and I hadn't listened to him. So I had to come back to America, raise $10,000 more. I went back in 95. And in 10 weeks, they build a 284-foot span bridge over the Brawley River. There are 5 800-pound steel cables that they carried 18 miles up the mountain trails to get this school built, or a bridge built. Well, I was 38 years old. I was a very diehard bachelor, and I was in grad school, and all I could think about this school in Pakistan. And I was at a fundraising dinner on September 13th, 95. It was getting kind of late. I went to the back. There was a beautiful woman wearing a dress and black combat boots. I started talking to her, and her name was Tara Bishop. She's the daughter of the late Barry Bishop, who was a chairman of the Research and Exploration Committee at National Geographic Society. And we kept on talking, and 6 days later, we went to the courthouse and got married. We're now living happily ever after in Montana with our two kids. My wife, Tara, she was in grad school, a clinical psychologist, and she also helped me use a computer and taught me this beautiful thing called cut and paste so I could start writing hundreds of fundraising letters. We kept working on the school. These are the men carrying the loads 18 miles up to the village. But 3 years later, you can see we hadn't gone very far. And actually, the problem wasn't them. The problem was me. I was doing something that we call micromanagement. I had my plumb line receipts and records, and I was determined I'm going to get the school bill, and I'm not going to lose $1. One day, Haji Ali, the village chief, he came up to me, and he said, "I've been watching you, seeing you frustrated and not getting anything done. If you really want to get the school built, you need to sit down and be quiet and let us do the work." He said a lot harsher words than I can repeat here. And then he took my plumb line receipts and records and he locked them up. Those were earthen locker along with his prayer beads and Holy Quran. He came back and he said, "There, everything will be just fine. Don't you worry." Of course, I was horrified. And I actually, at that point, went off to Waziristan to find a place to build a second school. I got kidnapped and detained for 8 days by the Taliban. Eventually, I was released. But when I came back a few weeks later, guess what happened? The school got built. And it was an important lesson to let go, let the communities be empowered. And today, it's kind of the core of all our schools. We provide the skill, labor, and the materials, but they provide free sweat equity, free manual labor, free land, free wood, free resources. And they also match that we leverage against the governments and bigger organizations. And that's why we can build a school for about a tenth of the cost of the World Bank. And let's see, so the school got built, and we had inauguration. It was a very beautiful day. The kids came, but if you look at Sikinder, you can see he has orange hair. It's because he has Kwashiorkor's disease. He's starving from protein malnutrition. And Fatima on his right, you can see lice in her hair. But despite those maladies, you can also see their joy at being able to go to school. Well, I decided in 96 to dedicate my life to promoting education and helping build schools and literacy in this very little part of the world. And the first thing that happened to me is I had a fatwa issued against me. And I've had two fatwas issued against me, one by a Sunni imam and one by a Shia imam. And the first one was banishing me from the country. So I sought out the advice of Syed Abbas Rizvi, who's the head Shiite imam in northern Pakistan. And he's a very powerful man, but also a very man of wisdom and compassion. And Syed Abbas said, "Let me find out." So he wrote a letter to the Council of Ayatollahs in Qom in Iran to seek clarification of what this crazy American, you know, who's working, helping put schools in their midst. And several months later, they summoned me into the inner sanctum of the Imam Bara Mosque in Skardu. And it was very imposing. And I thought, I'm going to get booted out of the country. But instead, Syed Abbas brought a red velvet box, and he opened it. And in that box was a letter written in the ornate Farsi or Persian script. And it read, "Bismillah al-Rahman al-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the merciful, the beneficial. We have reviewed your case. In our Holy Quran, education is encouraged for all children. And furthermore, what this man is doing in your midst is in the highest principles of Islam. So we give our blessings and our support." In the Quran, the Holy Quran, the first word of the revelation to Muhammad the Prophet is the word ikra. And ikra in Arabic means read. The first two chapters implore that people, all people, have a quest for knowledge. And so with that letter, we started getting dozens and dozens of proposals for girls' schools and boys' schools. But the more I do this, I'm convinced that, you know, we can drop bombs, we can hand out condoms, you can build roads, you can put in electricity. But unless the girls are educated, the society won't change. And several global studies show that if you can educate girls to at least a fifth grade level, it does three important things. One, reduce infant mortality. Number two, reduce the population explosion. Number three, improve the quality of health and of life itself. And the number two one I kind of am interested in because we have so many problems in the world today. And as we heard from Jeffrey earlier, you know, on and on, there's all these problems. And I think one of the main problems in the world today is there's too many people on the planet, and we're not living in equilibrium with our world and our societies and as nations and a global society. And if girls can have an education, that's the single most important factor to reduce the population explosion over 1 to 2 generations. And there's many countries that are example. One is the country of Bangladesh. So now I've got some really bad news, and I've got some really good news. So do you want to hear the bad news first, or do you want to hear the good news first? Bad news. Usually it's the bad news, okay. So the bad news is that since 2007, the Taliban and other jihadi groups have bombed or destroyed or shut down about 450 schools, and nearly all those schools are girls' schools. Now, why do you think a group of men would want to destroy girls' schools and not boys' schools? Because I think that their greatest fear is not the bullet, but it's the pen. And even more than that, they fear that if that girl gets an education, she grows up and becomes a mother, the value of education goes on in the community. I've also learned that in the Quran, that before a young man goes on jihad, he has to get permission, blessings from his mother. And if he doesn't do that, it's very shameful or disgraceful. And when a woman has an education, she's much less likely to condone her son going into violence or into, you know, extremism. Same as in the inner city when kids want to get into a gang or get into drugs. And also in the Quran, suicide and the killing of someone is one of the most, you know, unforgivable sins that you can do. And so there's, you know, many reasons, and I've found that women who have an education, they, you know, women bring life into the world, and they also want to help those children, you know, have a better life for their communities. Now the good news, and I can't see everybody out here, but maybe you can help me out a little bit. Over the last year, I've talked to about 200,000 people, and I asked this question, I'm going to ask you tonight the same question. How many of you know the fact that in Afghanistan today, there are 6 million children going to school, 2 million are female, and in 2000, there was only 800,000 kids going to school. Now, any of you know that fact? Is there any hands up there? Any hands? I don't see any hands. Out of, now we can say 202,000 people, whatever, about 40 hands have come up. Now, to me, that's the single most inspiring, incredible news to come out of that country, and nobody in America is aware of it. The media, the government, the think tanks, universities, and that's the kind of news I would hope to be broadcast from every mountaintop in this country, that there are 7 times more students going to school in Afghanistan than 7 years ago. Don't you think that's good news? Do you think maybe the local newspaper could write a little column about that someday? And the New York Times and other places? This is Hushay School. We opened it up in 98. I asked them to increase the number of girls by 10% a year. Of course, they don't know how to do the math there. And guess what happened 1 year later? This is how many girls are in Hushay. The young woman on the extreme right, her name is Shakila. Shakila first started writing with sticks in the sand. Today, she's in her second year of medical school in Lahore in Pakistan, scoring in the 90s. And she will become become not only the first female physician, but the first physician out of that whole region of 1.2 million people. And her education is about $600-$800 per year, and she's determined to go back to the village to become a physician and help her people. Now, her dad, Aslam, said, you know, it's much cleaner to be a teacher. You shouldn't become a doctor, but she went into medical school. And this is another example of what one brave young woman did with her education. This woman, her name is Aziza, and she's from the tribal areas on the Afghan border. She's the first girl out of about 4,000 girls to get her education, and it wasn't easy. In first grade, the boys used to throw stones at her. In third grade, the teachers refused to teach her because she was female. And when she got into high school, the boys stole her notebooks because they didn't want her to graduate. But guess what happened? Aziza graduated. In 1998, she wanted to become a maternal health care worker to deliver babies and do pre- and postnatal care. And the maternal mortality rate in some of these areas is 1,900 deaths per 100,000 live births. In America, it's about 25. And before Aziza started working in Charpersen in 2000, 5 to 20 women died in childbirth every single year. Aziza went to 2 years of training. It cost $800. She came back in 2000, and not one single woman has died in childbirth in the last 7 years because of a brave young woman named Aziza. And some of you, anybody from Orca School here? Where's Tracy and Rob? Sarah in the back there. Several years ago, there was a persistent couple, Tracy and Rob Harrington from Santa Barbara, and they kept kind of bugging me and said, we can really help you raise money and build a school in Afghanistan. And finally, I came down here and met, I think, 34 kids. And guess what happened? They raised money to build a school in Afghanistan, the Orca School. And it's their sister school now. They've been exchanging some letters. But I'd like to thank the Orca School for really bringing this hope and education to Afghanistan. Thanks. And here we are today with the Orca School, and there's Tracy and Rob. So I'd like to thank you so much for bringing peace and bringing hope into this community and also all around the world. Thank you. So we've got economists talking about the value of education. We have an imam talking about the value of education. We have the ayatollahs talking about the value of education. Let's hear what a U.S. military commander has to say about education. I get dozens of letters from people serving in the military, and pretty much all without exception, they say, without education, nothing will change in this country. I'd like to introduce you to Colonel Christopher Kalenda. He's the commander of the forward operating base in Nare. It's in Kunar province in eastern Afghanistan, where we're putting in some schools and education. He's in a very difficult, dangerous post, and the work is very difficult there. Last October, he sent me this email, and I'll just paraphrase a little bit from it. Can you see it back there? I am the commander of the Task Force Sabre, serving people in Kunar and Nuristan province in Afghanistan. Our primary goal is to provide hope for the good people of Afghanistan, particularly the children. Building schools is one of my top priorities, and I am convinced the long-term solution to terrorism is education. The conflict here will not be one with bombs, but with books and ideas that excite the imagination towards peace, tolerance, and prosperity. The thirst for education is palpable. People are tired of war after 30 years. Is education that will make the difference whether the next generation grows up to be educated patriots or illiterate fighters. The stakes could not be higher. So if we have the imams and the military commanders and economists and global leaders all talking about education, why aren't we doing anything about education? Last year in Afghanistan, we spent, well, this is 2006 now, $14 billion for the war on terror, $627 million for anti-narcotics appropriations. We doubled anti-narcotic appropriation. The opium production went up 60%. This year, we've doubled the anti-narcotic appropriation to $1.1 billion, and the opium production went up 30% more to 8,400 tons, which will bring in $3 billion into Afghanistan. In 2006, only $38 million went directly into education to help those 6 million kids going to school. So something needs to change a little bit. And, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about some, these are, you know, kind of hard to see, but this truck was bringing school supplies up to Saw Village, where we're trying to put in a girls' school for these girls in Saw Village. What happened, though, is that the community went down, they got the supplies and now Saw School. I don't have a picture, but it's going to be done in about a month. And the community really rallied behind getting the school there. This is the earthquake in Pakistan in 2005. And again, I'd like to talk about the education issues that came out of that. These were the statistics. 74,000 people killed. 18,000 were kids going to school at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. 500,000 children displaced out of school. And by this year, only 450 schools have been rebuilt. And there's still about 200,000-300,000 kids who were previously going to school that now are deprived of education. And at first, there was a heroic effort. The U.S. sent in 24 C-47 Chinook helicopters. They conducted the greatest helicopter airlift in the history of mankind. There were tons and tons of clothing sent over there. But guess what the women mostly used the clothing for? To cook with, and they used it for fuel. Thousands of tents were sent there. Most of the tents were highly implosive, and hundreds of kids died or got burns because there was people packed into tents with candles and lanterns. But nobody did as they went over there and asked the people, what do you want? How can we help you? The one group of people that did listen was Turkey. They sent in about 50 people to do assessment. And what the people wanted were little kits. They call them home kits. And they were consist of a hammer, nail, saw, binding twine. It cost about $60 each. They purchased 200,000 of those in Pakistan. People were able to go back to their village and rebuild their lives in the community. But it was because of people there, they were listening to what the people wanted. And within less than a year, the aid dropped 70%. In the wake of that, many jihadi groups have set up refugee camps. This is the Jamaat Islamiyat refugee camp. And 2 miles, this is north of Muzaffarabad in Azad Kashmir. 2 miles south of here is the El Rashid Trust. It's run by Dr. Aziz Amir, who was Osama bin Laden's personal previous physician. He's a British-trained orthopedic surgeon. He spent 2 years in Guantanamo Bay. He's come back, and he's running a refugee camp. And 5 miles from here was a U.S. 212 MASH unit until last year. Now, they all were trying to help the people, but in these camps, they had a duplicitous agenda. If you look in the back, you can see on the right-hand side is a mess tent, and on the left-hand side is an extremist madrasa where the kids are getting indoctrinated, a very violent type of ideology. Now, I showed this picture in Capitol Hill last year up at the Pentagon. And they told me, Greg, this should be a classified photo, and you shouldn't be showing this in public. And the irony is that if we put a school in that camp, the IRS would shut us down overnight because we're affiliating with a terrorist organization. And, you know, when the politics gets involved, what's so important, though, is that the kids there, they want to go to school. It only costs about $1 to $2 per month for them to go on with their school. So that's what I'm kind of trying to deal with right now, is to really help be able to really help those children and kids with their education. And if you ask most women, you know, I go to women, I say, I'm here to help you. I'm your servant. What can I do to help you? And you'd think most women would say, what I really like is a good husband, or I'd like a big house, or I like prosperity. But what most women tell me are two things. Number one, we don't want our babies to die. And number two, we want our children to go to school. And I think the real answer to that is very obvious, is that we can help those girls and those children have an education and be able to go to school. We don't have the money to build all the schools we'd like to. We mainly focus on teacher training and scholarships and education. But we do try and do whatever we can. This is in Maidan Shah in Afghanistan. This is our school. It's a armored personnel carrier. There are 12 ninth graders going to school inside here, and they're learning English. And we salvaged a truck container used to bring over U.S. military supplies, and we converted it into a second grade classroom for 80 kids. And the girls, we can't even get a truck trailer, so they're going to school outdoors in the dirt. You notice they have their shoes off. And it's not because they're trying to get comfortable or being cool. It's because they're so honored and they have so much respect to go to school. You go to any school in Pakistan, Afghanistan, you usually see the kids, they'll take their shoes off because they're very honored to go to school. Some of these young women have walked 2 hours to go to the Maidan Shah school, and they've taken their shoes off because they're so honored that they're able to go to school. I've been called a lot of things, and some people say I'm really crazy because I leave my family. I go wandering around the sticks in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and I'm not a responsible family man. But you know, and in the back of Three Cups of Tea says I'm an Indiana Jones fighting the Taliban in their own backyard or something like that. But you know, I'm just like any of you. I'm a dad. I'm a husband. I'm a veteran. Most of all, though, I'm very passionate about education. I'm also very concerned that in America, we have a poverty. And that poverty is a poverty of compassion and the willingness to have compassion and love. And I'm hoping, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to help leave a legacy of peace for all our children. And when I look into the eyes of my children, I see the children in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Africa. And I think we should do everything we can to leave them all a legacy of peace. And I also owe it to my wife, Tara, who's encouraged me so much along the many years. After 9/11, I'll get back in. This is last August in Chunda Village. It's in a very remote area in Pakistan. And my kid, my daughter Amira, and my son Khyber Khan, we were opening up Chunda School. It took us 8 years to convince the mullah to open up a girls' school in Chunda. And we opened up the school last year. There were 74 girls in school. This year, there are 340 girls going to school in Chunda Village. In Kalepanj, in the Wakhan, in very remote Afghanistan, we had registration for school 2 years ago, and I started watching the kids come to school, and I started looking down at their feet. I saw their Chinese rubber boots, their flip-flops. Some of them were barefoot. And then I kept looking at the ground, and I saw these little impressions in the ground of their boot prints and their footprints. And I thought back to 1969, when Neil Armstrong first stepped on the moon, and he said, "One small step for man, but one giant leap for mankind." And as I looked at those footprints, I thought that's one tiny footprint for that brave young girl. But behind that girl comes dozens of other girls, and eventually hundreds of girls. Eventually they become mothers. And that's one giant leap for that community, with the steps of that brave little young girl. It really was the peaks that brought us to Pakistan and Afghanistan, but the people that bring us back and back again. So here we at the end here. In early 2001, I go back every year to villages, and it's so wonderful to embrace the people, and I really love to be with the people. When I got back to Pakistan in 2001, Haji Ali was very sad because his dear wife Sakina of 50 years had passed away. And we walked up to her grave, and she was in a box facing the west towards the sunset. In a very rare moment of sentiment, he said to me, "Without her, I am nothing." And then he said something that I never forget. He said, "Very soon, you're going to be standing here, and I'm going to be in the ground." And he kind of chuckled. And I didn't think that was very funny, because my dad had died, and my sister had died, and all of us, you know, we lose somebody who's dear to us, and you just never get over that. And he said, "When that moment happens, I want you to do one thing. I want you to listen to the wind." And I got back to Corfe in 2001 in October, and I was in Pakistan 3 months before and after 9/11, a very tumultuous period. And after 9/11, the State Department, the embassy, even my board directors, they said, "You've got to leave the country and come back to America. It's not safe there." But I had a lot of work to do, and so I called up my wife, Tara, and she said, "You know, stay there. You're needed over there now, and the people love you, and finish up your work and then come home." And so that's what I did. And everywhere I went, I was surrounded by an outpouring of hospitality. A very poor elderly widow named Hawa, she brought me 5 eggs, put them in my palms, and she said, "Please take this back to the widows in New York who are suffering. And I'm sorry, I have nothing more to give you." And everywhere I went, that's what I felt. Finally, it came time to come back to America. It was Halloween Day, 2001. I walked and landed in Denver Airport, and as I got up the concourse, I saw all these American flags everywhere. And I called my wife and said, "What's going on here? It looks like the 4th of July." And she said, "You know, you've come back to a changed country, so take time to really understand what's happened here." And I went home, and I started opening up my mail. And I started getting hate mail, and subsequently, I got death threats. And it wasn't from people in Afghanistan or Pakistan. It was from Americans. People called me a traitor. Some people said, "You should die a painful death because you're worse than the enemy. You're helping the Muslim children try to go to school." And the only time in my life I thought about quitting my work, because if somebody in if I'm in Afghanistan, somebody's harming my family in Montana, I want to go home and protect my family. But again, my wife Tara told me, "You just need to get out in public and talk about what you're doing and talk about compassion. Talk about what people really want is they want hope and they want schools, they want education, and they want a better future for their people." And that's what I did. And what I found is that American people were good people, were compassionate people, and were very generous people. You know, if the thing, though, that I hope that can happen is that if we fight terrorism, it's based in fear. But if we promote peace, it's based in hope. And the real enemy, whether it's in Afghanistan or in Africa or in America, the real enemy is ignorance. And it's ignorance that breeds hatred. And to overcome ignorance... we need to have courage and compassion. So finally, go back to Corfe again. I'm going around a circle here, but October 2001, I got to Corfe and Haji Ali had passed away. It was very difficult. I walked up to his grave and he was buried in a box facing the west towards the sunset. And I looked down, just as he predicted, I was very sad. And then I remembered what he said. He said to listen to the wind. And so I listened to the wind, and in the wind I heard the voices of the children in the school. And I realized that his legacy and his vision had come through true with the education of his children, and they had seen the light and the light stars in the dark. And I also thought back to some very precious moments in the evening when Haji Ali would read the Holy Quran or Persian poetry. I often noticed that he'd have a tear in his eye. And I asked Haji Ali once, "Why are you sad when you read the Holy Quran or Persian poetry?" He said, "Greg, actually, I don't know how to read. And it's my life's greatest tragedy that I never learned how to read and write. It's my life's greatest hope that my children and my grandchildren can learn to read and write." And I also realized that after a decade, I had come full circle. Because I hadn't found the field of dreams in a cornfield in Iowa, and I hadn't found the field of dreams on top of a big bad mountain called K2, but I had found the field of dreams in a little dusty village in a place called Corfe in Pakistan. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.